sunshine, little Uber, liver, liver, lead us.
Good evening. Welcome to As the Worm Turns. You are tuned in to KVNF's live call-in gardening show. I'm Jill Spears, your host, and I'm here with my two favorite gardeners, Lance and Lulu. Howdy.
Hello.
Hi, everybody.
Super excited. Special guest Laura Parker from High Desert Seed Company joining us tonight. Hi, Laura.
Hi, everybody.
Laura's been on the show before. We've been up to her seed farm here in the North Fork, and she is just a brilliant woman with a wealth of knowledge that she'll be sharing with us tonight. So we invite you to participate, 527-486-8866, KVNF now, worm at kvnf.org.
Wow.
Oh. Wow.
Wow.
Lance's hand signals going. And we got Jeff in the control room, so if you go call in, you get to chat with Jeff. All right, let's get started. We're here for an hour, and so much to talk about. We all know how important seeds are and seed saving, and Laura's going to walk us through it. And Laura, I want to start out with some of your background, because truly believe you were born to be right here where you are now. Your path is amazing. So can we start with that? And your family came to Colorado and got into regenerative farming and ranching.
Yeah, we were really ranchers. We were very early adopters of holistic management. So that's Alan Savory's, rotational grazing. And really, we considered ourselves like grass farmers. And we were trying to improve the ecosystem and improve the diversity of the forbs and monitoring that. And doing that also with, the economics was an important piece, the social and the environmental. Those are the three pillars of holistic management and decision making.
And how long ago did you start that?
Well, my dad started doing that in the 80s.
Yes.
Like, 1987 or something, I believe, because...
Yeah, that's early.
Yeah. Yeah. Because there was a whole thing when he started doing grass-fed beef and actually feeding it to me as a baby. And I wouldn't eat the CAFO beef.
Oh, really?
I would only eat the grass-fed. Okay. And he was like, okay, I'm all in.
Cool.
That's so
I was nice. The guinea pig.
Yeah.
Well, you're a pioneer woman here as well.
Yeah, so I like to say that, I'm like the turncoat of the family, but also my family, we always are about promoting diversity. I think that's like a common thread of, yeah.
Yeah, so you were...
the work.
Nice. You were here in Western Colorado, and then is when you started to really get into seeds, is that when you went to college? Is that when that all started to... come together for you?
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah. So when I went to college, it was apparent that many of my colleagues didn't really know where their food came from. And so my friend Sarah Rubin and I, who was a comp lit major, I was a biology major, we started an organization called Food Chained. So we brought students to farms, and we brought big speakers like Michael Pollan and Joel Salatin. And then Vana Nashiba and Alan Savory.
Wow.
So we had over 30 events in the course of 2 years.
Wow.
And actually bringing Vana Nashiba, she was probably like one of my hardest speakers to bring, because she was an international speaker, but probably like the most important to my life. A friend of mine was like, please bring this woman. And any student engagement, I was like, let's do it.
Yeah, so Vandana Shiva, for those of us that don't know, ecofeminists, describe her and her activism and why she's so instrumental to what you do.
Yeah.
Amazing woman.
So she is a big-time seed activist, really fighting GMOs and kind of farmers being forced into the Green Revolution, which has had major societal impacts in India. They have like a very high rate of farmer suicide there. And it's also, it's a country that is primarily peasant farmers. And so, seeing the huge loss of diversity of their seeds, Vanda Nashiva really got involved in this. She's actually she has a doctorate in physics, which is an interesting note about her. But she got very inspired to start to do kind of rebuild traditional seed banks and work with communities, really starting with the women, because the women culturally are the seed keepers there.
Right. And she mm-hmm. really raged against the chemical companies for genetic modification, especially the Terminator seed gene, where you couldn't. You couldn't save your own seeds. You had to keep rebuying them because they were engineered, genetically engineered, to not reproduce. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, if you want to think about that for just a minute, we're talking wheat and grasses and your grains being genetically modified so they can't reproduce.
And cotton too.
Cotton.
It's really actually the you know, the package deal of the seeds and the chemicals was what you know, farmers were sold in India, and then buying into it, they have to buy into the whole system, and it's a whole different change and mechanization and all of these things. And so what often happened was that the seed costs then would go up exponentially. And yes, you can't save those seeds because they're proprietarily controlled. They're restricted. And so many times people got into deep debt and lost land that had been in their family for hundreds, if not thousands of years actually.
Right.
So there was a high rate of farmers committing suicide, you know, drinking the herbicides or the pesticides or the fertilizers.
That had to hurt.
So I got really in passionate about seed sovereignty and really the extreme loss of biodiversity in our food crops. And also it was an amazing thing to witness there in a culture that is so tied to the land, unlike our own, when we have less than 1% of us that are farmers, and there the majority of people are farming, how quickly, like, the knowledge of saving seed and how quickly the diversity of seeds is lost. So, for instance, like rice, you know, from every little valley, there used to be their own types of rice.
And
there were thousands of varieties of rice that had been lost, like when I was there. While I was there, it was actually, we were cleaning the rice harvest. It was the season after the rice harvest on the farm I was working on. And just seeing all of these varieties of rice, like hundreds that we were maintaining, laid out, and seeing that diversity in, like, living color, the purple, the red, all the different short grain and long grain rices. And that was just a handful of the actual diversity was kind of mind blowing and inspiring to me. And also, together with, you know, I often tell the story of on the ranch in Colorado, my parents were actually from West Virginia. So when they moved, my mom and dad were always big gardeners. And so they moved to a place that was 7,000 feet in elevation and were undertaking growing a garden. So, as you guys know, not all, you know, things that grow in West Virginia easily will not grow at 7,000 feet.
Right, not so much.
These things all coalesced within me to kind of feel that this was a really important piece. And after coming back from that, I needed to go come back to the States and do this work myself.
Yeah, that's amazing to start an organization and bring speakers in because your friends didn't really understand where their food came from, and all of a sudden you find yourself in the middle of India with these peasant farmers really in the thick of it.
Right. And these were college-age people.
Yeah.
Who didn't know where their food came from. That, to me, I can't even fathom that.
Well, and they just had no connection.
They had
to,
no connection
to agriculture and to
carrots.
I mean, which
come
we're
in a plastic bag.
It's huge right now. Yeah, it's absolutely huge. Yeah. So she definitely. I can see her inspiration in you. I think you're carrying on her message. Just a couple of quotes from her, and I know this one you love, Lulu. Is we need to value nature's biodiversity. Clean water and seeds, and for this, nature is the best teacher. Mm-hmm. And that's really speaking to staying away from the chemicals and the GMO GMO seeds.
Yeah.
All right, yeah. So you came back from India, and then...
And then the fun started.
Yeah. Well, I did a lot of different things, actually, but to cut to the chase a little bit, I was, when I brought Vandana Shiva, I was actually working on a seed farm, the very first organic farm I worked on, which was like an organic garlic farm. And at the time, he was getting into more types of seed crops. And he, long story short, he like left for a whole month during kind of the seed harvest and basically gave me the original seed saving book, which was Susan Ashworthy's book, Seed to Seed.
Oh, yeah.
Which is like a little bit limited, actually. Yes. It's not totally a complete picture. And so I got kind of like thrown into the deep end of learning to save seed and also witnessing the magic of seeing, you know, he was growing leeks to seed. And I remember just being in awe of like these huge blooming heads and that huge tall stalks, you know, they're like almost like 5 feet tall. And then we had beets growing to seed, which was a total fail, but like I got to see the plants become these huge, massive, dready, locked things. Right. So I was pretty much hooked at that point. But I ended up doing different things in agriculture and then working for basically the Organic Seed Trade Organization in the United States, the only one that exists. OSGATA, yeah.
And what do they do?
They advocate for organic seed growers in the nation. So one of the things that we ended up becoming the lead plaintiff in a case against Monsanto, actually, which was an interesting look into the judicial system. We were really in the patent system. We were going after them in patent court. And it was really the seed growers that we were representing and all of the 300 organizations and all of that were concerned deeply about the seeds that they were trying to grow organically being unintentionally contaminated. And then them being sued because of unintentionally having their... Yeah. Their patents and genetics.
Right.
Their crops were getting pollinated by the GMO crops. So Monsanto said, hey, what are you doing with our GMO stuff? And they're going, what? So, yeah, that was really... And one of those was a big case. I think it might have been in Canada where the farmers won. They shut Monsanto down. I'm pretty sure it was in Canada, because in this country it was exactly the opposite. Monsanto won, and there, you know, we're talking pollinate. We're talking blowing in the wind. If your field was next to a genetically modified field, and those pollens cross the road, you were liable.
Well, and it's not only that, like an organic seed grower, like in the Pacific Northwest,
yeah,
for instance.
Yeah, and then there's that, yeah.
When they started doing GMO sugar beets, for instance, like basically they told, the seed companies basically said to the grower doing organic and wanting to not have that technology, well, you have to put in, you know, a 4-foot hedge around your property to protect from the bombs. So they put the burden on the other grower, not the grower that's choosing to use the technology. Which is
heavy-handedness.
Yes,
seems
know.
A little not right, but
right.
Anyways, we're getting into the weeds here.
Yeah,
well,
but,
yeah.
But that's part of that's part of the advocacy of this organization was the litigation against these big seed companies and supporting organic seed growers. And your company, obviously, is High Desert Seed is all organic seeds.
Yes,
yeah, that is. That's in your blood and your bones, girl.
Yeah. Yes. And we don't support like any kind of proprietary restrictions on our seeds as well. We do work collaboratively and believe in supporting traditional plant breeders. Like, so we do send some royalties out to the University of Cornell, who's done really awesome, but like conventional breeding work, just because those breeders sometimes are at it for like 10 years, maybe more, and they have really good things. So, but we don't sell any hybrids or any utility seeds with utility patents on them.
What does that mean?
A utility patent?
Yeah.
So that's kind of the that's the big shift that has happened. Where we used to have plant variety patents, that was like a lower form mm-hmm. in the USDA that you could have with cultivars or seeds, and that allowed for breeders to still use that those genetics. And farmers to still be able to save their seeds. It just required that a seed company send royalties basically back or pay for that, the right to sell that variety that was bred. But then what happened was there was a case with a bacterium that was being genetically modified to clean up oil spills. And basically they went to the Supreme Court and that was the first life that was ever patented. And so ever since then, so this is in the utility patent, in the patent system, like the system that would patent this mic, basically, like patent a machine or the way something works.
Okay.
And so a utility patent has changed the game because it is a restrictive. It doesn't allow breeders to have access to that, those genetics, and farmers can't save that seed. It's a highly restrictive control.
Whoa.
Yeah, and with all of these big corporations coming in and litigation happening and that kind of thing, we've just seen the diversity of seed decline significantly.
Yes. So that's like that's one of the biggest concerns with the high use of utility patents in this way and restrictive controls and hybrids, is that it makes it harder for breeders to gain access to genetic resources, and it's really limiting the amount of things that we have access to and that exist, and we're losing varieties and losing our diversity.
yeah, and
was it 80%? 80% of lost food crops?
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yes.
80% have been lost.
Yeah, the importance of diversity, you see it in every system. I mean, it's got to be there
matter.
For life to thrive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
527-486-8866, Caving Up Now. You can also email us, worm@cavingup.org. Our special guest is Laura Parker from High Desert Seed Company right here in the North Fork. How did you move from this critical role of supporting organic seed growers and advocating for them to actually starting your own seed farm?
Really, personally, for me, it was the fighting and this kind of thing in this way was not for me. I still am fighting, but I just wanted to get my hands dirty and actually do the work and do the work of supporting biodiversity I think it's really important that we don't just have our seed. I think seed banks are incredibly critical as a backup,
mm-hmm.
and we're really at risk in this current moment with the Grin seed bank that exists in Fort Collins, with it losing funding and some of its staff right at this current moment. And I think everybody should look into that and be concerned. Because we need those resources and the land races and the highly bred varieties to go back for disease resistance and all of this. But for me also, like getting things out of the seed bank and taking them into different regions and selecting them and involving them within the climates and the soils and also the growing systems, like the regenerative systems that we want to have our seeds built for. Was incredibly critical.
I mean, seed banks, like you said, are good, but if you're not growing that stuff out every few years, it's not adapting to the climates, the changes that are happening.
Exactly.
You mentioned just in that little bit the term land races. Can you describe what that is?
Yeah, so there are a few different kind of definitions of a land race.
What? Like the gun goes off and everybody takes off on their horses and buggies?
Well, That's not the one. But in terms of plant, they can be kind of like wild types that like are the natives that exist, can be referred to as a land race. Or it can be a variety that has been basically taken in and has a wide genetic breadth and has been selected by a community over time. So a land race, for instance, a land race that we sell is the Hopi purple green bean. And you can see the inherent diversity within that variety. And the Hopi, you know, it's really indigenous knowledge that these land races exist in. It's a beautiful thing. Have maintained this genetic breadth and also selected it for specific traits. So this variety is very drought tolerant, and it also, you can see within the seed the genetic breadth that it has. It's many different colors. And, you know, that is, I think land races, I'm more and more interested in pursuing land races. They need to be, you know, you're kind of pooling genetics and then selecting them over time, and they're, you're being selected both by the creativity of the farmer, like, and the culture, and by the climate, and the growing system. So, you know, for us, clay soils or pushing them for drought tolerance or short season is very important things. That those are all things that we do at High Desert. You know, that's going to inform it, but it requires a long period of time to select it and really have something vital. And it's setting it up for being able to, you know, seeds have the memory of past seasons.
Wow.
So they hold the memory of like a potential like pest outbreak. And, you know, you save the ones that made it from that, or like a freak frost or something. And the ones that made it are those seeds that you save. They hold the memory of those seasons. So when you get extreme climate chaos, you know, they're going to have more resilience in that memory bank.
Wow, that's amazing to even ponder.
I find it interesting just with the carrots that I grow every year. And I've been doing this for, I don't know, 15, 20 years, growing them out. And in my situation, I have 7 varieties, and they're actually having a tendency to all grow and look the same.
You've mentioned that before.
Yeah. You know, just with my conditions and stuff.
Interesting.
You know.
So are they all thinking alike?
Yeah, they are.
I mean, that's holding the memory. I mean, it's...
Well, they're thinking adapt or die. And so they're in there, and there's these little nuances.
You know, that's just what's going on. So, and they still have their traditional shapes and colors, but they're sort of moving to the same thing.
Keeping you on your toes.
I could tell a story that it was was a talk that I recently gave on the farmer campus that Katie Brim, which y'all should look up, is putting together.
I had a conversation
with another plant breeder, Steve Peters, who was one of the original guys working with Seeds of Change. This is kind of a story within organic seed community that I love and gives me hope that I'm doing good things with my work. But he tells the story of the dark star, the breeding of the dark star zucchini, and it really started with a farmer, Bill Reynolds, that was dry farming on the Ill River Valley in California, and he wanted to breed a zucchini that could be, you know, had good faceting and would, you know, be shipped well because he's a big grower and this and that, but also that was an open pollinated crop, not a hybrid, but had the vigor of some of the most common hybrids. So they actually took a hybrid and crossed it with another OP that had a very vigorous form and undertook breeding this over in a dry farmed area. They worked with another, he brought in another plant breeder, John DeVazio, who really was an amazing man because he was a plant breeder, but he really believed in the wisdom of the farmer. And so he kind of just guided this breeding project along with Steve Peters, who also is a plant breeder. And so they really participated together in this plant breeding project and ended up with the Dark Star Zucchini. Now, this is where the story gets really cool. So Bill Reynolds had a farm down in Baja where he farmed in the wintertime. in the Baja Peninsula. Mm-hmm. Apparently, a lot of the zucchini for the winter season is farmed down there. And anyway, so down in Baja, there's tons of zucchini growers, I guess. And there was a freak frost that normally doesn't happen. And basically, it wiped out all the varieties of zucchini growing down there, except for the Dark Star.
Whoa.
And that year, because the Dark Star had, because of the dry farming, it had like a more tap-rooted system. It had a different root system, and it had more drought tolerance, and it also somehow related to this tolerance for the cold. And so it died back, but it grew, it survived and grew back. And it was actually the only zucchini that winter on the mark on the organic market throughout the nation.
Wow.
Right. And
which
Lance, right? Because the cells of the plant, when it freezes, they fracture. And that's what makes it, the moisture in them. So if the Dark Star was so super drought tolerant, that might have been the sole reason, because there wasn't as much moisture in the individual cells. And the plant figured that out all by itself.
Well, I think it goes to the fact that he was dry farming the crop, and that was part of the breeding.
Yeah.
Like, I think we really need to take in that we need to be breeding in the systems that we really should be growing in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That we want to be growing in. You know, most of our seed is grown in highly, like, chemical systems, and they might not even be grown, most likely not grown in the United States even.
Yeah, you were talking about that before the show, that a lot of our seed from big corporations is coming from places in the world that aren't even similar to the climate and conditions we have here.
Yeah. You conventionally think that, like, the seeds you're buying from a seed company are grown, like, in the region or at least in the nation. But that is the majority, no matter what the size of the seed company, is mostly not the case. They're mostly getting seeds from international seed houses. And so they might be growing in, like, you know, really amazing areas for dry seed farming, where it's a dry fall and really good for dry seed. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm talking about Chile or Israel or, you know, California or the Pacific Northwest is where a lot of the dry seeded crops are grown. So, they may not even be grown in the U.S.
Wow. Well, you have given us a great introduction.
Not in the high desert, in the mountains.
Right.
Climate.
So you've set us up well to talk about the importance of growing seed here and what high desert seed does on your farm. And we're going to hear from a couple underwriters, and we'll be right back with Laura Parker on As the Worm Turns. All right. We are back. You're listening to As the Worm Turns on KVNF. Lance Lulu in the house with me, Jill Spears, and our special guest, Laura Parker from High Desert Seed. 527-486-8866, KVNF Now. You can email worm at kvnf.org if you want to pick this woman's brain and talk about seed saving and growing plants for seed. And we were just getting into how you started your company, Laura. You started in Montrose, right?
Yeah, so I started in Montrose. I've worked on a farm where we trialed a ton of varieties, and that was kind of the beginning. And then my dad finally was like, when are you going to just come here and farm at our place? So that's what I did, yeah. And started in 2015, so I'm going into my 10th growing season.
Wow, congratulations.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, we just...
to learn a lot, too.
We continue to learn every year. I don't think I'll ever cease in learning. I don't think anyone in agriculture really stops learning.
Right.
Every year sends a new twist and turn your way. And we're always trying to explore new crops as well. I think I just get more inspired and have had many... lucky meetings with people that have inspired me to pursue and, like, get creative with the crops that we're growing. And
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you're still trying to find new varieties?
Yeah.
Because not me. I'm going the other way.
I know.
So you're narrowing down?
Just some.
Yeah.
Just some. Actually, I'm not taking anything new.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all.
Your seed rack, you have one in Farm Runners and in several other places around the area. And you're now here in the North Fork. You've moved your farm up here to the mm-hmm. North Fork.
Yep.
And it's amazing. And I think when you were talking about watching these plants grow out and get big and bushy, I think that's what we observed when we did Worms on the Road up at High Desert. Was
yeah, you were right at that.
Well,
yeah, because it was fall.
Yeah.
Right? So, yeah, it blew me away.
Yeah, it looked a lot different than a food farm and or garden.
Yeah, yeah.
But there is so much organizing and planning and systems that you have to have to run this as a business.
Yeah, you know, we have over 300 varieties, and we probably have another 300 varieties that we're working on bringing
right.
forward. So, yeah, we love spreadsheets. Me and my team and Tori has really helped to – we've gotten some major database systems going, and we do managing all of our accounts, and we have like almost 50, I think, seed racks out there in the world. Mostly in the Southwest, but and then yeah, managing all of our varieties and all of our, you know, we do germ testing to make sure mm-hmm. we're selling really high quality seed, and during the growing season, you know, we have to dry the seed and cure it and process it and get it fully finished, clean for sale, and
yeah, so yeah. many stages.
No
to
rest
that,
there.
Right? Yeah.
No.
Yep.
Yeah, and that's, I think, the Southwest, that's that acclimation of your seed to this high desert arid climate that we have in Southwest Colorado.
Yeah, yeah, and we also have, like, seed racks in the Grass Valley in California, also a high desert. You know, there are more high desert zones throughout the west cool. part of the country.
Mm-hmm. Grass Valley has a couple of good seed people as well. Mm-hmm. Producers and things. I know some of the stuff I've bought over the years came from that area.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we sell through Peaceful Valley. That might have been who you bought from.
Oh, yeah, it was.
Organics, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, their stuff is cool. That was your stuff? Was their stuff?
Well, we have some seeds that we sell through them. No. Just in the last couple of years, yeah.
Awesome. Awesome.
Yeah, and yeah, I would assume that your partnership is growing with people as more and more people understand the importance of saving and growing seed and what that means to our whole food chain and our life.
Yeah, we are finding people catching on.
It is a time for people to wake up to this. I mean, it's critical. You know, we can't keep kidding ourselves that everything is going to just keep being this wonderful, bountiful, low-priced food. It's a myth that's coming quickly to an end, I think, personally. I mean, just from the bee things that, for instance, you know, that Amber was talking about last show we did, last week.
Yeah, and we were chatting before the show that, Laura, you had a chance to sit on a call with some farmers and talked about bees a little bit. And do you want to share some concerns? Because bees are our life. I mean,
right. And
it
what
is
was
so
that,
critical.
Right. And what was that number that Amber threw out there that of how percentage of the population failed over
50
the
to 60, 70%.
That's
yeah,
ridiculous.
It's estimated to be even more this year. So it's serious stuff.
Yeah, and when it comes to seed crops, there are so many seed crops that are pollinated by bees. You know, squash and all the brassicas. Like, bees are elemental. I mean, of course, almonds is a huge industry that completely mm-hmm. rely on bees. They are very elemental to agriculture and to our food and getting to the table. Like,
right.
Yeah.
And the bees are dying, you know. Well, yeah. The almonds are so heavily managed. sprayed and everything else, and then the bees get in, and then some of those chemicals that they use to preserve those crops are systemic, so it doesn't matter about the time of day you spray or whether the bees are there or not. The poisons are in the food. So if they're in the flower and in the food, guess who else they're getting into? Yeah. So
we're just at a karmic tipping point where we have to make better choices.
Yeah.
Shane from here in Paonia is on the line. Hi, Shane.
Hello there.
Hi.
Good day. Hi, worms. Hey, I just wanted to mention an experience I had. Back in the early 1980s, I was contacted by a Canadian researcher who asked me to go investigate or check into the National Seed Storage Laboratory that was at CSU and still is there. I believe it's a USDA project. And he said, would you go check and ask him about their security? Because the future of the world might be dependent upon how secure that site is. So I went there. And they welcomed me, and I went through the tour, and I asked them about their security. They said, well, make sure the doors are locked every night. Huh? And this researcher in Canada was worried, like, you need some major security. This is like the future of the world here. And this is way before the gigantic seed storage lab that was built in, I think it's Svalbard, Denmark. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
was it Carrie Fowler that asked you to go?
I'm sorry, what?
Was it Carrie Fowler that asked you to go check it out?
You know, it was.
Uh-huh.
It was.
There it is.
I probably could have never remembered his name if you hadn't said that. And then he quoted me in an early report that he did, and I will always love the guy because he called me Dr. Shane Smith, which I'm not a doctor. I only play one in my mind, you know. And they just said they locked the doors really good.
Yeah.
And then I went back on another tour, and I talked to some other seed storage experts, and they said, you know, there's a problem with these seed storage labs. There's a thing called genetic drift, and that is, just because we put them in cold storage forever, the genetics do not stay the same. They drift. The only way you can preserve them is to keep growing them out. And then grow them out, but not enough. And this researcher was very worried about how often things are not being grown out. And to see these places lose their funding is totally disconcerting.
Yes,
it is. And, anyway, I just wanted to add that little tidbit to your great show. Thank you, Worms.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling, Shane. Good to hear from
you.
That
was awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, and just as we had our spring membership drive here at KVNF and talked about the risk of losing some funding, that's happening at research places all over, and some of that.
And as a matter of fact, that's what the call was about mentioned. That I was on with some other farmers, and it was a call actually to express our concern about grant funding being lost and also firings. And some of the firings that they were discussing were bee researchers and also funding for research. And the woman who wasn't the expert on our call, the farmer, and she was like, I don't know what the people in the honey industry are going to do to figure out what the root of this issue is with the high 60-70% bee loss. So yeah, these are really important
people. Yeah, important projects.
Yeah, and I was talking to Amber today and asked her about her bees, and she said, yeah, because she just has a small number of hives, she can manage them and protect them and keep them healthy and happy. But these people that have 5,000 hives, you know, you just can't. Mm-hmm. You can't do it. So I'm thinking what I'm hearing is diversity, once again, is the key. You know, if you could keep a hive of in your backyard, just one,
Mm-hmm. And that's actually the researcher, that was her work that was speaking on the call, was breeding diversity into the bee population, actually.
Yeah, right.
She was like a bee breeder. I was like, wow. What? Mind blown.
Wait.
Love that
idea. Yeah.
Right? But amazing creatures. Yeah. Pay
Love
attention.
It.
Yeah.
Love
everyone
it.
Needs to pay attention.
Yeah.
So how do you plan on what's going to go in the ground up at High Desert Seed? Has that happened years before?
Does sometimes, for sure. We're running variety trials, and we're doing some really strategic variety trials where we put things under intentional drought pressure. I might have mentioned that when you guys came out on the tour. You know, so we have a whole dry farmed or low irrigation area where we water every 15 to 30 days. And if we get any kind of moisture, from nature, we reset the clock. Those things are informing then what we grow to seed more intentionally in those trial areas in future years. And we also grow flowers and these type of things. So we're often working on small projects and increasing our seed supplies. But we're particularly interested in, I'm personally particularly interested in getting gardeners to grow staple food crops. Mm-hmm. So, we're getting more into wheat and we sell a purple barley that is originally from Tibet, and it does amazing in our climate. It's really an incredible food, and it can be eaten as a whole grain. It's so good, just
and
roasted
that's
in the pan.
One.
Yes,
because I had a Tibetan barley with all the different colors.
Oh, cool!
That a friend smuggled out of Tibet.
Yeah,
wow!
It sounds like a land race.
Yeah. It sounds like
yeah.
a land race.
Yeah, I have all. It has three colors.
That's awesome!
Oh, gorgeous!
Yeah. Wow!
Yeah. So one thing that we're starting to work on, which I would say I'm not necessarily an expert on anymore. Is growing upland rice. And who inspired me to do that? Really, I saw it originally in Source Point Seed or Unpaytu's seed catalog. Which I think seeing Unpaytu's seed catalog act, I was just thinking about that on the drive here, was really inspiring to me because he was growing in Hotchkiss and, had all of these crazy things that I didn't think could be grown in Colorado. And and anyways, he's continuing to inspire me with that. So, yeah, we've been growing a couple different upland rices and had some great success with that last year. And one of them is the variety that Unpaytu was originally offering in his catalog.
Wow. So, yeah, I have this naked space over at the house next door that I want to regenerate. And I was been thinking and thinking, and just today I said, why don't I just manage that soil as best I can? It needs to be scraped off a little bit because there's all this road base. But what if I just did some cover crop of something super durable and drought tolerant? I'm thinking that might be the answer.
Yeah, like a sorghum or amaranth, like a domesticated amaranth that's a little kinder than the wild ones, can
that
be really
be
good
beautiful.
For reconditioning really compacted soils. So I'm guessing it's a really compacted soil there.
Well,
it's all around a high house site. Yeah,
it hasn't done much forever.
Yeah.
It had a carport and cars on it and all kinds of gravel.
Yeah, amaranth is very tolerable to poor soil.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it would be pretty.
Yeah. And these crops seem to speak to your whole thing of food sovereignty. I mean, to have these base crops that you're growing, not just what you want to grow in your garden and your favorite, tasty tomatoes, but things that really sustain us and are critical to being able to feed our community.
Right.
I'm curious when you say staples and grains and stuff, what do you think of as square footage? For because I find 200 square feet will give me about 25 pounds of grain. And if it's
200 square feet?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that could be, but also it's something about, too, just growing even a 20-foot bed of a grain mm-hmm. and saving that seed and selecting it for your region and like maybe even just having 2 cups to eat in your home.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And but and like playing around, it's just a, you know, it's a special thing to interact with because we don't usually grow a lot of the like the staple foods that are in, you know, wheat that's in every meal mm-hmm. and wheat that's like, yeah. you know, the golden staff, right?
Right.
You know,
is 200 square feet 100 by 100?
200 square feet is, come on, 4 by 50. 4 feet by 50 is 200 square feet.
Oh, I get it.
I like what you say, Laura, about it being fun. And I think that
that's
people
easy.
Who start to save seed and you see it at the seed exchange, mm-hmm. there's a lot of enthusiasm around it. And it's pretty exciting to yeah. get this yield of amazing amount of seed.
Yeah, it's pretty nice. I was on a webinar with Stefano on Saturday, and we're doing that once a month, just a garden talk. And one of the people listening, she had a jar of 100-year-old turkey red wheat.
Wow.
That has mm-hmm. it's actually was grown 100 years ago.
Oh, no kidding.
Oh, well.
I'll be darned.
You know, that no, it could still be pretty good. I told her to sprout it, sprout some, and see what the percentage was.
See yeah. if it grows, yeah.
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 Well, that's where all the heirloom stuff came from, isn't it? I mean, somebody went up into Grandma's attic and found packages
there
of
usually
seeds.
Usually have been grown continuously.
They're Viable. I suspect it'd be maybe 30% germination mm-hmm. or less.
Yeah, so when I approach something like that, like, and I've gotten some really cool varieties that are questionable in their mm-hmm. their vigor and germination from Anpeitu. And when we have, and actually many other people, when we have something like that, we'll actually baby them, even if they're a grain in the greenhouse, just to get them, like, kind of give them the most yeah. nice growing
yeah.
environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then after that, once we get some seed and get it going, then we start to be rough on them.
Yeah.
Selection for what we want. But yeah, we'll baby them in the greenhouse and then transplant them out. So we've done that with like a corn that was really old and had questionable vigor. And I made the mistake one time of planting an older corn just directly out. I tested it to make sure it was mm-hmm. had germ would germ, and it would. But it couldn't handle being direct seeded in the soil. It needed to be babied. So that one I lost, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But these lessons,
yeah.
these hard lessons inform your future.
Right. You're doing science up there yourself. I mean, you're not just growing plants out for seed and putting them in a package. You're actually hardening them and really making sure that they work in the climate, acclimating them.
Yeah, that's something yeah. I think, you know, I think seed growers and the people in the seed community are kind of really undervalued. Like if you're a good seed grower, you're, you know, when you're putting your lettuces out, you're really roguing for off types and you're roguing for those early bolters because we want to be constantly putting selection pressure towards it, holding it as a head, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, same goes for radishes and these type of crops, you know, and that those pieces of really becoming, I like to say, a plant Jedi. And like and really interacting and being a steward to the seeds, or you know, I kind of see myself as a midwife to the seeds. The seeds are not
sure.
my seeds. I'm just a midwife to the seeds. That's mm-hmm. that's something one of my mentors, Rowan White, has said, and I really that's what I feel about it. You know, when you're doing that well, you're really kind of evolving and pushing the seeds and working in relationship with them. In more intentional ways. And yes, it's kind of,
yeah.
it's science.
Absolutely.
It is a bit.
And I hear all the time about that you do have great germination rate. People that buy your seeds get great germination. So it's working up there.
Yeah.
And you're growing still. I mean, you're going to work on adding
evolving,
a new
yeah,
building.
And new
yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. You're really expanding your knowledge and your
yeah.
what you grow and what you do.
Yeah, and one thing too that I think is another part of it is like we are a regionally adapted seed company, so we're really focused on selecting for our particular bioregion. And when I say that, it's actually much deeper than just one season
sure.
many times. So
sure.
I think I might have told you guys about the sesame project that we have going on. And, you know, I didn't sell that for 7 years because the first probably 4 years of it, we barely, you know, they were like, I don't know, 8 inches tall and barely made seed. But we got seeds. So I was like, success, we got seeds. So we kept going. And now, you know, they're like maybe five feet tall, the plants, and are productive seeds. So, and we get that consistently the way we're growing it. So, you know, that regional adaptation, I believe, has taken place. We've also seen that with our quinoa population. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's what it's about. It's right. Really committing to it and growing it over time.
About how in the Native American culture here, growing things was so important. And you go down to Mesa Verde now or any of these places and you go, how did they do it? Well, that's how they did it. You know, they managed themselves and their food so elegantly, precisely.
They weren't distracted.
No, they weren't, right?
I'm talking about...
Modern life.
Modern life, yeah. So they were paying attention.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And they managed to survive and grow all this food down in these incredibly desert, barren, you know, if you've ever been to Canyon de Chelly or any of those places, it's astonishing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What would you advise just us regular old gardeners out here that really want to get into seed saving? What are some techniques, some great plants to start with?
Well, I think that everyone should save a seed. Mm-hmm. And your approach is a little bit different depending on what your goals are. But a good seed to start with are like more of the self-pollinating crops are a nice one to start with because they require mm-hmm. like a smaller population size because they're self-pollinating. Mm-hmm. When you have more outcrossing or crops that require pollinators, you need a bigger population size and a bigger growing space. But you know, they're easy too. so growing something, you just have to be aware of, you know, outcrossing. And if your neighbors are growing a cucurbita pepo or another zucchini, it might get crossed up with their zucchini. Yeah. But and then you might get something weird the next year, but you might have a breeding project on your hand. But,
right.
Yeah, but the delicata, what was it?
Oh, that delicata pumpkin.
Pumpkin. Yeah.
That I had.
Yeah.
It was beautiful.
We
ate
good.
It.
Yes,
yeah.
We did.
Yeah. We festered that rascal up and ate it. It was great.
Yeah. And I bet you find some surprises on your farm, you know, that you come across that are growing out. And you're like, what?
Yeah, we're always looking for a surprise and having our eyes out. Yeah, and we're looking for those plants, too, that are thriving out ahead of all the other ones. Because I'm like, okay, that one we're going to save separate, and we're going to have this as, like, a breeding line, or we're going to make sure that's in our stock seed.
I love your midwife description, because you really are
raising
these.
I'm keeping track
of
all that stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know how you do it. That's awesome.
Well, we're improving those systems all the time.
Right? Oh, my goodness gracious.
Yeah.
I'm curious, do you know anybody? Are you interested in potatoes?
We were actually just talking about this the other day. It's kind of like a whole other enterprise doing, disease-free certified seed potatoes. It's really a whole different enterprise. But I don't know. We were talking about the loss of some of the varieties that we used to see on the market. And mm-hmm. We're like, maybe we should explore potatoes, but
yeah, I bet there's a lot of dreaming and just fantasizing about different varieties that you could grow. And I think you're making those dreams become a reality. I mean, it's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was telling somebody the other day, you know, I'm very like practical and all about the numbers when it comes to my produce operation. But then on the seed, I'm just like, no hold barred. Like, we'll try.
We'll go for
anything, you know?
Yeah.
And so sometimes the projects and the breeding projects maybe aren't all that practical, but I think it's the right way to go.
How about a couple books just for the listeners? Seed-saving books.
Oh, seed-saving books?
Yeah.
The Organic Seed Farmer by John DeVazio is amazing.
Mm-hmm. I have that one.
Yeah, and then the Seed Savers Exchange... The mm-hmm. seed What is that one called?
Seed to Seed?
No. That's the Seed Garden.
The Seed Garden, yeah.
Yeah, we used that one for the seed class 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Another book that I'm really enthralled with right now, and I've asked the Paonia Bookstore if they would carry it, is Restoring Heritage Greens. It's a very inspiring book for me right now. And also, since Cary Fowler was brought up, his book is amazing. It's called Shattering. And Cary Fowler actually is the man that created the Svalbard Seed Bank. That's a really cool connection that Shane Smith brought up.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, and Shattering is, I recommend anyone that's concerned about seed issues reading that book. And it's very hard to find, unfortunately. So if people are, maybe we can get more copies printed.
Yeah, there's a demand for it. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Laura, hello. What a delight to have you here. Laura Parker from High Desert Seed. Thank you for sharing your expertise and for what you do. Super important.
Super important.
You are a gift to this community and the world.
Yeah.
So
appreciate
take you. Take a plant and save seed.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yes. Thanks for being here.
And have fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Mostly. Have fun. Yeah.
All right. That's going to do it for us tonight. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening to As the Worm Turns. Global Express coming up next on KVNF.
All right. Have a good evening.
Good night, everybody.
Bye.
Be kind.
You've got a cute fast pocket master, which you can make both slow and faster. I don't know who you took a shine to, or who you're about to make a sign to. I got a gal that I love so, low, little low and low.